Welcome back to Embodied. Today's conversation is one I'm really excited to share. We're diving into a topic that can feel a little edgy, maybe even a little taboo, but at its core, it's really about living more fully in our bodies, our relationships, and our lives. My guest is Benjamin Forrest. He's a retired military officer who spent over 25 years serving our country. Like many veterans, he's faced his own struggles with trauma and decades of treatment-resistant depression. Then, through a guided psilocybin journey, he experienced a profound breakthrough. That one night set him on a completely new path, one that eventually inspired his book, Trip of a Lifetime, The Psychedelic Guide to Healing, Loving, and Living. I met Benjamin at the Esalen Institute earlier this year, and when I picked up his book, I could barely put it down. It's raw, it's honest, and it's deeply moving. And while it's framed around psychedelics, it's really about something much bigger. And that's how we prepare for transformation, how we walk through the hardest parts of our life, and how we can integrate the wisdom we learn back into our daily existence. So whether or not psychedelics are part of your journey, Benjamin's 10 invitations are universal practices, things like surrender, self-love, and savoring aliveness. They're reminders we can all use to live more present, embodied lives. So let's step into this conversation with curiosity and openness, because sometimes the most powerful lessons come from the places we least expect. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Kathy. Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to see you.
It's so nice to see you. Your background is so unique. You've spent over 25 years in the military before writing Trip of a Lifetime. Can you share what brought you from that world into this world of healing and eventually writing this book?
Yeah, absolutely. What brought me to the medicine was a combination of depression and desperation. At the end of 25 years of military service, I came out broken, I think it's fair to say. By the time I retired, my medical records were full of many diagnoses, depression and sleep disorders and so on, and nothing was working. And it's not that I hadn't tried to cure these things. The problem was I had tried everything to cure these things and nothing was helping. The VA had nothing to offer me but medications that didn't work and therapy that wasn't getting through. And so out of desperation, I went down this rabbit hole of how do I heal myself? And then this magic moment occurred when I saw a TED Talk, actually. The TED Talk is by Dr. Rosalind Watts from Imperial College, Can Magic Mushrooms Unlock Depression? And as soon as I saw her TED Talk, I was like, boom, that's it. That's me. Because it looked like psychedelics were not a Band-Aid, but actually a pathway to get to root cause. And so while doing psychedelics might seem like an unusual choice for a military officer, I was on a mission. I was on a mission to cure my depression. And I found a pathway and I went at it with the same focus and energy and decisiveness that I would go after with a military operation. And as crazy as it sounds, one single night with a heroic dose of psilocybin in a ceremonial and therapeutic session, boom, the depression disappeared in a single night. And somehow, like, I knew that was it. The depression was gone. And we are nearly 5 years after that event, and I can honestly say the depression is gone. And it's not that I don't get sad anymore. Of course I do. But now when I'm sad, I know why. And it's a passing thing. For me, depression was being sad and not knowing why. So, yeah, I had my big experience with psychedelics. And after that, I was like, okay, this is my path. This is my calling. This is what I am devoting the rest of my life to.
I love that. I'm hearing you say you're suffering from deep depression, right? And trauma, stored traumas, and nothing else was working for you. So this was actually a therapeutic path for you to try to discover something that could get you to a place where you could come out of this deep depression and experience life in a more positive way. And many of our listeners, I would think that psychedelics in general, the word is taboo. It can be associated with a party drug or reasons other than therapeutic use. And you're talking really about the therapeutic benefits that it's brought to you.
Yes, absolutely. And people can do psychedelics for recreation. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, but that's not my area of interest in the area I talk about. No, when I approach psychedelics, it's approaching a sacred medicine. It's approaching, I would say, even a spiritual medicine. This, as strange as it sounds, has become my spiritual path. I didn't look for that. I just wanted to cure my depression. But in the curing of my depression, it became actually so much more.
So much more in spirituality. And I think that with Embodied and our podcast, it's really that spiritual path that we all can follow. And it's the awakening. And for you, this was psilocybin. I'm really curious to hear more. Maybe you could explain to us what you do in your book.
Sure. Yeah, I wrote the book for somebody who maybe can't even spell the word psychedelics. But at the end of 200 pages, they're actually going to be better prepared than most people are going into this journey. For me, it looked like there was this gap in the literature. There are so many wonderful psychedelic books out there, but there's a tendency for them to be academic or journalistic or memoirish, where it's kind of about, you know, my personal journey. And I thought what was missing was that simple self-help book, that self-help book that has, here are the principles, here are some client stories, here are my personal stories in this inspiring and entertaining and engaging way. I had an alternative title to this book that didn't make it, but that alternative title was The 10 Habits of Highly Psychedelic People, because that's what I was trying to do. Like, here's the self-help book for psychedelics.
Right. Yeah. I love it.
And in the introduction to the book, I walk the readers through, okay, what are psychedelics? Why are they important? What are the different types? And what does this mean for you? Along this path, since psychedelics, I went to school to study to be a therapist. I thought that was going to be my path. I fell in love with Carl Jung in particular, and he has this quote, "Until the unconscious becomes conscious, it will rule your life and you will call it fate." And so much of psychology is about rummaging through those subconscious patterns that are controlling us and trying to bring them out into the light. And of course, there's many ways to do that. There is, you know, talking with a therapist. There is dream analysis. There's many ways to get back there into the mind, into the subconscious. But there is nothing like psychedelics to provide such a clear and direct path. What psychedelics do, I think, in essence, is they allow the subconscious for a few hours to come out and unload and play and let those patterns come out into the light. And when those patterns and those contents of the subconscious are brought out into the light, they lose some of their power over us. So, yes, it's connecting to the divine, but it's also connecting to the parts of us in our mind that have been locked away and can't be acknowledged. It is the unloading of the subconscious.
And you talk about MDMA, psilocybin, ayahuasca. What was ketamine was another one. I hear a lot about ketamine now as well, ketamine therapy. Could you start by walking us through MDMA?
Yeah, of course. I divide them into two categories. There are the natural medicines from plants, fungi, even frogs. And then there are the artificial medicines where we're talking about LSD and MDMA and ketamine. So with MDMA, it's technically not a psychedelic. It's an empathogen. It is, which is an interesting word, right? It's the gateway to empathy. And so in a four-hour MDMA journey, we find ourselves in a space where our defenses are lowered, where empathy is enhanced, and where we're able to be in a place, frankly, of love. And this has become extraordinarily important in the treatment of PTSD and also, I would think, in couples therapy. But the focus right now with MDMA in the world of psychedelics is around the treatment of PTSD. There are cases, and I talk briefly about one in the introduction to the book, where a veteran can have an MDMA therapy session and go back and explore their trauma but explore their trauma from a place of love. Mm-hmm. So imagine a veteran who had a traumatic experience in Iraq, for example. They can talk about that experience, but their fear is gone and the anxiety is gone and the, you know, frankly, rage can be gone, like whatever's going on. Like, and suddenly they can talk about that experience in a place of calmness, a place of love, a place of empathy. And it's kind
of
like,
actually be able to externalize it, right? Kind of release that trauma that perhaps been stored in them for so long.
Yeah. And so what PTSD kind of is getting stuck in a moment of trauma. And you have this traumatic event that just you can't let go of. And with psychedelics, they can sometimes be like the opposite of PTSD, like a blissful experience that creates a permanent change in your mind versus the traumatic experience that makes a permanent change in your mind. And we have seen multiple times, it looked like we were very close to the legalization of therapeutic use of MDMA because it is such a compelling treatment for PTSD for veterans. Of course, it's a compelling treatment for PTSD of all kinds, but there seems to be a unique sympathy on all sides of the political spectrum around veterans. And so organizations like MAPS have done tremendous amount of research around the treatment of PTSD through MDMA. And
then you also mentioned ketamine, right, and LSD as the artificial psychedelics, right, that are not natural.
Yes, and ketamine is an interesting one because it can be legally administered. There are clinics all over the United States where you can go in and have a ketamine experience under the care of medical professionals. And so that has become the one that is most accessible, most legal, and it's gained a lot of attention there. And LSD, the creator of LSD, Albert Hofmann, this goes back to World War II and even a little bit before. He wrote a book about it called My Problem Child. LSD is an amazing molecule, but it became associated in the late 60s with the counterculture movement and the anti-war movement. And so in 1970, Nixon, out of pure political motivation, created a essentially a ban on the research and use that was around LSD, because here was a way to go after political enemies. Let's make LSD a Schedule I drug. And so with the exception of ketamine, almost all psychedelics are Schedule I drugs since 1970, which means two things: strong potential for abuse and no medical utility. And this is madness to say that psychedelics have no medical utility. That flies in the face of every bit of science and research that we are aware of. So LSD is an amazing medicine, but yeah, like Albert Hofmann coined it, it became a problem child too because of political issues going on in the late 60s and early 70s.
It's interesting. I've heard that before.
Conspiracy theory. Members of Nixon administration have completely been transparent about, no, this was politically motivated. This was to go after our political enemies. And that's really shifted. Earlier this year on the Joe Rogan podcast, former Texas Governor Rick Perry went on and talked about psychedelics. And I quote him a few times in the introduction. He says, "I am a complete believer in plant medicine. You cannot argue with the data." And that is where we are at. We need to support plant medicine because you cannot argue with the data.
Well, I love that you're bringing all of this to light. Can you tell a little bit about the natural psychedelics? So one of those being psilocybin, which you call in your book, The Flesh of the Gods. You also talk about ayahuasca, and I find that fascinating and would love to learn more about that as well.
Yeah, certainly. So I'll start with psilocybin. Psilocybin is magic mushrooms. Is the medicine that broke me through into this world. This is the one that enabled me to cure my depression. And it has been in use for thousands of years. The ancient Aztecs were the ones that called it flesh of the gods, which is such an interesting little phrase, because what does that sound like to somebody from a Christian background? That sounds an awful lot like communion. And so in the ceremony I did, it was a bit of a church. the participants were the congregation. The psychologist who is handing out the medicine is the priestess, if you will. And the magic mushrooms were the sacrament. And it's a very powerful medicine that can be taken in small microdoses, that can be taken in more mild doses, or in the case of the therapeutic use, typically the heroic dose, 5 grams or more. And that is what I took in Mayasari and Moni and what transformed me. And at this point, I would say that psilocybin is the most studied psychedelic on the face of the earth. And I would say the safest as well. And that is not strictly opinion. There is data based on the likelihood of visiting an emergency room when taking a substance. So way over here, we have things like, you know, cocaine and methamphetamines and, oh, yes, alcohol. And then we have over here on the low likelihood of having to visit the ER, something like cannabis. And even further over is magic mushrooms. So on that list of the major drugs, psilocybin is on record as being the safest in terms of likelihood to have to require medical attention. It is fascinating medicine.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so another is ayahuasca. Ayahuasca has also been used for thousands of years. It comes from South America. It is a blend of two different plants that provides a 4-hour journey, and it's called the grandmother medicine, and is said to have a strong maternal energy, which makes sense to me because when I go to ayahuasca, I'm either being scolded or I'm being soothed. It sounds a whole lot like a mother. She'll want to spank me for misbehaving, but when she's done spanking me, she'll hold me. And I've had experiences of tremendous bliss with ayahuasca. And some people get a little scared of that one because it is known to cause purging, which is typically in the form of vomiting. And I understand why that might sound unpleasant to people. It is like this energetic release. It is like the letting go of trauma that has been trapped inside there. And energetically, ayahuasca seems to bring that out. And there's other ones. San Pedro is an amazing cactus, also used for thousands of years by the indigenous people, North and South America. 5-MeO-DMT from the venom of the Sonoran desert toad that provides a very quick, almost near-death-like experience. And there are so many out there. Iboga is an interesting one. This is the one that Rick Perry is advocating for. It has been very effective in the treatment of PTSD and traumatic brain injury for veterans. And where I first heard of Iboga was in line at the Esalen Institute. I was waiting to get some food and I struck up a conversation with the man in front of me and he said something very interesting. He said, I used to be a heroin addict and then I took Iboga and I've never touched heroin again. The most effective treatment for opioid addiction that we know of. And the tragedy is that Iboga is a Schedule I drug right next to heroin, even though one is the cure for the other.
I know stories where that's also transformed people that have had opioid addictions, heroin addictions, and that have used psilocybin as a way to actually break them and have been cured. So it's interesting that you say that. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about psilocybin. I think that might be the introductory
Sure. Yeah.
Molecule it's that someone good, would want to try to experience.
Gateway drug to the healing. Yeah. It's a very flexible medicine. It's become very popular for microdosing. Some people will take a regular regimen of it. And for some people, it replaces antidepressants. For me, I am all about the heroic dose. So Terence McKenna was a voice in the psychedelic world, particularly in the 90s. So kind of like there was this period of really wonderful research in the 50s and 60s around psychedelics. And then it got cut off in 1970. And then in this century, the research is picking back up. And in that middle period, Terence McKenna was an amazing advocate for psychedelics. And he had a recommendation around psilocybin that was very simple. He said, take 5 grams, lay down, close your eyes, and surrender to whatever comes. And it's so interesting to me that that simple prescription from Terence McKenna decades ago is actually the basis of most of the research that has gone on at places like Imperial College, where they take 5 grams, they'll typically put on eye shades, and they will simply let their subconscious unload. So I'm not against, you know, microdosing. That works for people. That's wonderful. But that's not actually my area of interest. My area of interest is going for those big doses that create such an overwhelming experience that you almost like have to surrender. If you fight it, it becomes worse. But if you can absolutely surrender to the experience of what the psilocybin is bringing up for you, I think that is the invitation to transcendence.
I hear you say surrender to the experience, and surrender to the experience when during an ayahuasca journey can be pretty brutal. So the idea of surrender in life in general, I think that's one of your 10 principles that you kind of outline in the entire book, is just this idea of surrender. So if you're surrendering into a medicine or you're surrendering into life, I don't know, I just find that fascinating. So maybe you could touch a little bit more on the concept of surrender. So if someone's going into a journey, what does it look like, or what does that surrendering involve?
Yes.
Because you're going to purge, right? You say you're purging now. If you're doing ayahuasca, we're going to be purging for possibly hours. Our psilocybin can also cause purging as well. So, and during that process, you have to give in and surrender. So tell me a little bit more about that process.
Sure. My first experience, as we were in the ceremony getting ready to consume the tea, the psychologist was up there giving various pieces of advice. And at the moment, like, it was so hard for me to take in. And so in my notebook, I was taking notes of all of her advice. And then I just crossed it all out. I crossed it all out and wrote one word, surrender. So what does surrender look like in the medicine? It is allowing what needs to happen to happen. So it's very physical for me. Like, my body wants to move. And so surrendering means just letting my body do what it wants. For my first 2 hours of my first psychedelic experience, I was just sobbing and sobbing. Now, I could try to fight back the tears, hold it in, and play the boys don't cry game, or I could just let the tears come. And oh, I let them come. I let them come. And I also, in that first experience, I began like beating my chest. I don't even know why I was doing it, but just my body and my mind and soul, whatever, just wanted the beating of the chest, almost like I was banging on my heart, just trying to like let it open. And I think if we try to control, like, oh, there's something coming up, I don't want to look at it, I don't want to go there, we're not going to make any progress. But surrendering means, okay, there's a place I need to go. It's terrifying me, but I'm going to go into that cave. I'm going to go into that cave that scares me. There's a quote from Joseph Campbell, one of my heroes. He used to teach at Esalen. And he would say, in the cave you fear to enter is the treasure that you seek. Mm-hmm. And if I had to like crystallize the psychedelic experience, I think that sentence gets there. There are these places we're afraid to go, we're afraid to face, and maybe we can't even face them in our conscious, sober state. But in psychedelics, there is that opening to go into that cave and to face what we are unwilling to face. And maybe that's feeling the pain of a trauma. Maybe that's admitting some insecurity that we have. It could be anything, all that stuff that just frightens us. But if we actually go into that cave and we actually surrender and allow it all to unfold, we do indeed come out with a treasure. And for me, that treasure was more than just the relief of depression. That treasure was bliss and an entirely new way of being in this world.
So if you were to relay that to somebody who has not experienced a psychedelic experience, the object of surrender in life, the idea of surrendering and letting life just roll through you and giving faith that it will work out, that's a big piece. Any guarantee of what's going to happen, and I can control anything in life or in this world.
Yes. And as a recovering control freak, I can appreciate that. Life rewards control freaks. The military loved me being a control freak. That's part of what made me a good military officer, I think. But surrender is the essence of the spiritual path. I think if you were to really look at the essence of Buddhism, of Christianity, of Islam, it really is about this surrender to the divine. I've been a fan of Eckhart Tolle for a long time, and I remember one talk he was talking about affirmations and saying something along the lines, well, I'm not, you know, particularly big on affirmations, but if I were to give one, I would suggest this: I trust in life. Uh-huh. The wisdom of life has been kicking around for about 13 billion years, and we are just a little speck in the universe. And we're not actually in control. We're not in control of the universe. We're not in control of the world. We're not in control of the political movements of our country. And I would go even further. I would say we're not even that much in control of our life, our DNA, our environment, our patterns that are trapped in our subconscious. They're controlling probably 99% of what we do. And the irony is, when we can surrender to that reality of how little control we have, I think actually that creates the opening for conscious choice. And Michael Singer is another spiritual hero of mine. He wrote The Untethered Soul. The Untethered Soul, if I had to crystallize that, the message of that was keep the heart open. And keeping the heart open is not trying to be in control. It's just allowing life and the energies to flow through there. The other book he wrote, his memoir, was called The Surrender Experiment. And that was a autobiography, a memoir about his decision to surrender after a profound spiritual experience. And as the book unfolds, the more he surrendered, the more magical life became. And it became magical along this spiritual path and the founding of the church in Florida that he is affiliated with. And it also, curiously enough, made him a wildly successful man. He didn't have a background in medicine or in computer programming, but he wound up creating a medical software that made him a very successful businessman. And so this spiritual path of surrender and this material path of success, he was able to balance
the two.
Yeah. I think surrender is not just at the essence of every psychedelic experience. I think it's actually the essence of life. I think it is the core of the spiritual path.
So interesting to even to think about that in context where we're not in control of what happens to us, that we're this idea of manifestation,
yeah,
and how we actually manifest, which could be a whole other topic of conversation.
Sure.
But it's just kind of all leading into this whole surrender experience. You also talk about in your book, on one of your 10 principles of psychedelia, you talk about two other ones which I'm very interested in is healing connection. Specifically, I guess we're talking about community, right? And when you went through your experience and you surrendered, you entered this cave, right? And you opened up your heart. You did this in community, right? So
yeah,
the ability to use that community around you to help you through this transformation.
Yeah, there was a inner wisdom at that time that knew I had to heal in community. I didn't want to do this alone. I didn't even want to do it one-on-one with a psychologist. I wanted to do it in community. And I'm at a point in life now where I have decided I am never going to do psychedelic alone. I need to do them with at least one other person. And my preference, honestly, is to do them in community. So why is that? So when you think about our core wounds, our deepest wounds, they're always in relation to other people. Maybe it's something to do with mom who didn't, you know, love us the way we needed to be loved. Maybe it's something to do with dad who couldn't process his feelings because of these prisons of masculinity that we put ourselves in. Maybe it's the kids on the playground, bullying somebody. Like, all of these wounds from our childhood are always happening in relation to other people. And just as we're wounded in relation to other people, so too are we healed in relation to other people. There is, I think, a profound group healing that can happen that can't happen alone. I don't think I can heal alone. I think I can only heal in relation to other people. I think that is the magic of the medicine, is that connection. That connection to the divine, that connection to ourselves too, but that connection to other people.
Yeah, I agree with that in the business, in the space that I have my life in. Mm-hmm. It's about community, and I, you know, love, and I see how important it is to, whether it's healing or whether it's, you know, improving your personal strength or whatever you're working on, the power that comes with a community around you that can support mm-hmm. you as you go through this journey of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, of course, met at the Esalen Institute. And one of my favorite things about the Esalen Institute, there's a lot to love there, but one of my favorite parts
so much
is the connection to other people. It is so rewarding. It is so satisfying, and it is so healing to connect in a profound, deep level with another human being.
Just from a workshop that we formed this special connection, sharing of information that has brought us all to stay in touch, sharing the struggles of what this workshop was intended to help us with, and kind of watching mm-hmm. each other grow through it.
Yeah, and there's so much love and support and humor flowing even months later across the electrons of WhatsApp. It's it is so profound. For me in particular, when I think about group healing, like, that really speaks to my core wound. You know, I grew up so isolated and so lonely that, yeah, being in community is tremendously soothing. And I am not alone. We have probably all seen, you know, articles around this epidemic of loneliness. And the male loneliness epidemic. And the Surgeon General in the last administration said that loneliness is harmful as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, I think it was. We are so isolated, and we have lost community in this culture. And I think that's why depression and these other illnesses are so acute right now. And we spend so much time alone, so much time looking at our screens, and not enough time relating in a genuine and loving way with other people. And this loneliness can literally kill us. And it's primal too. Like, I talk in the book about how we are wired for belonging, because go back thousands and thousands of years, a caveman by himself cannot survive. We cannot survive without a tribe, without a community. And so our body knows that. Our body knows that to be alone, to be truly alone, is unhealthy. And so that feeling of loneliness within us is that prompt to go connect. And if we can lean into that loneliness and seek out genuine human connection, there's the cure. But if we feel that loneliness and we don't do anything about it, we can get trapped in that loneliness, and it can just destroy us, both metaphorically and ultimately even physically, I believe.
I agree. The power of community is huge. Mm-hmm. Also, I want to, in your book, in the early chapter, I think you talked about the 10 principle of being, one of the principles of being the hero, right? So we're the hero in our own story, in our own story of life. And how does that apply in your book?
Yeah. So when I was a young man, I actually had the word courage tattooed on my hand. It's been lasered off since then. And I was thinking a lot about physical courage at that time, right? I'm about to join the military. And now it is about emotional courage. And we are all on the hero's journey, whether we know it or not. And we can think about the story of our lives in that way. I could tell the story of my life in a way where I'm the victim, and it can be all wallowing in self-pity. But I can look at that same life, and I can think about it as a heroic journey. And it's a lot more empowering that way. But I specifically talk about the hero's journey in relationship to psychedelics because, yeah, you kind of do have to be a hero to go do this. The first principle I talk about is courage. It does take some courage to go have a big psychedelic session. It does. I have so many friends and people I've talked to, and they're very curious about psychedelics, but they're afraid. They're afraid.
Yeah.
And that's that lack of courage, that keeps them from going on that psychedelic adventure. And there's other, phrases and qualities of a hero that I talk about in there. One of them is honesty. To heal, we actually have to be radically honest with ourselves about what is going on inside of us and where we're at and where we need to go. And the thing about the hero's journey is, yes, we do have to dig deep and find some strength and answer that call to adventure and go off to face what we need to face. But at the end of the hero's journey is what I call the elixir, which, of course, I borrow from Joseph Campbell. And that elixir is what you gain from that hero's journey, what you gain from going into that difficult cave with courage and fear pumping through your veins. And when you come out as the hero, you have a treasure. And that treasure might be peace of mind. It might be the relief of guilt. It might be joy. Psychedelics for me, like split time. I can look at my life and see everything as before and after. Before psychedelics, I was so burdened by unconscious patterns and by grief that I wasn't willing or able to feel. Like I was just weighed down, like this dim character of myself. And when I came out, it was bursting with joy, bursting with bliss. And it was this just palpable like energy and frankly like charisma that other people could feel. Like, oh, I found a treasure. Like
when I met you, I also saw this really human side of you that was joyful, happy, and energetic. And I would never know that you had suffered through many years of depression and of what you went through. So when you're saying to the transformation that happened prior, you're pre-psychedelic and post, I've experienced you in the post-psychedelic, and it's hard to even imagine when you talk about in your book, the pre-psychedelic Benjamin.
Yes, it almost seems like two different people, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it does.
It didn't change me. It revealed me. That's how I look at it. It revealed me. And psychedelics aren't going to be an instant cure for everybody. You know, many people have very complex trauma that's going to take, a lot of work. And psychedelics might not even be their answer. But it was the answer for me because the root of my depression was actually incredibly simple. And the phrase I used in the book to describe it was emotional constipation. I was unable to feel. I had suppressed and repressed emotions for decades, right? I was a boy who was raised by a very stoic father. I was taught that boys don't cry. And then I joined the military where you are trained to put away all of your fear, all of your feelings, and go out there and do what must be done. And there's a moment for putting aside your feelings and doing what has to be done in an emergency. That's essential. But if that's your way of life and you're not feeling anything, all those feelings get trapped up and you become what I call emotionally constipated. So that was my problem. That was my depression. I was emotionally constipated. I was unable or unwilling to feel anything. And I thought that was a way to avoid grief and fear and insecurity and all those things. But no, you can't avoid any of that. It just gets stuck. And so my heart had become almost calcified. And so if you have emotional constipation, what's the cure? An emotional laxative. And that is what psychedelics became for me, this emotional laxative that was allow all those grief, all those feelings to finally flow out. And that's why that one experience with psychedelics was so profound. It cleaned out my heart. It just cleaned out my heart. And the problem with like locking up your heart and your feelings that way is it doesn't just trap the bad feelings, it traps the good feelings too. The good feelings can't get through. So once the heart was cleared, oh, I can feel joy now. I can feel passion. I can feel this like lust for life that just wasn't possible before. When your heart is cleared and your heart is open, all the good feelings are there too in a really intense way.
So you become the hero in your journey, and that requires a lot of courage to stand up. Hero in life, it takes courage, right? You can go out there and you're battling this major dose of psilocybin that you did. What do you call it? The a hero dose.
Yeah.
Yeah. This hero dose, which required a tremendous amount of courage. You're not tiptoeing into microdosing. You're now in the hero dose. Yeah. And when you go into the cave, like you said, and you have this awakening. You have this awakening. One of the other 10 principles, which I think is equally important to actually going through this experience, is live your elixir.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? And how does that apply to this experience?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So the book is divided up into essentially three parts: preparation, navigation, and integration. And when we approach psychedelics, those are the stages. How do we prepare for the journey? How do we navigate it when we're in there? And then that third piece, integration, that is the key. Because if I go off and I have a psychedelic journey and I get all these big revelations and all these big movements, and then I simply go back to living the life I've always lived and I never integrate that into my life, what was the point? It was just an interesting experience.
Right.
And so I spend more chapters on integration than anything else in the book. And yeah, the phrase that I start with in the integration section is live your elixir. So you've gone into that cave, you face what you need to face, you come out with that elixir. You need to treasure that. You need to treasure that treasure, because if you don't, you're going to lose it. And so what that means is, how do I bring those lessons of psychedelia into my life? If the lesson of the psychedelic journey is to go apologize to the people I've hurt in my life, if I don't do that, I'm not living my elixir. If the message of the journey is to quit drinking and I go right back to knocking down beers, I am not living my elixir. And so whatever that message, whatever that revelation, whatever that voice from the divine or your highest self is, we have to find a way to bring that into our lives. And I don't know what that is, because it's different for every human being. For some people, it might be taking up a meditation practice. For some people, it might be leaving a job that is just sucking out your soul. It might mean ending a relationship that you've been in for a long time that is simply not healthy for you or the other person.
I remember reading that one in your book, too. And that's something that you said actually happened to you.
I'd been married for 25 years, and after the psychedelic journey, I just saw everything differently. I saw things with such clarity, and I saw that for me, I was not going to find my happiness and my bliss if I remained in this marriage. I view it as a successful marriage. We raised two beautiful children. We were together for 25 years. I consider it a successful marriage, but once I looked into my subconscious, I thought, it's time to go. I always tell people, wait at least 2 weeks, better yet 2 months, before making a major life decision, like leaving a relationship or leaving a job. But yes, we can find a clarity in there that shows us, you know, what is right. Today, my ex-wife and I have a very loving relationship. I joke to my friends, I'm a much better ex-husband than I ever was a husband.
So different ways you can actually start living your elixir. Someone who's going to venture into psychedelics maybe needs to know that there could be this profound revelation that happens that could end something, or could be the end of something maybe toxic in your life, or whatever it is that's revealed to you. You have to be ready for these revelations that could, and be prepared if you're going to do this hero's journey to integrate those. It could be challenging. It could be life-changing. It could, you know, change the course of your life. So something to consider. I also read in your book about one of the other ways of integration that I personally loved is creativity and different ways that we can express what we, you know, learn in life or in a psilocybin journey or ayahuasca, and how we can integrate that using creativity. So maybe you could touch on that, because that's something all of us are creative individuals. We are all creators. And if we can create as a way of integrating our life and moving forward, I think that's a wonderful place to be.
I believe that we were created by a creator to be creators. I think that is divinity. Divinity is when we create. That is how we reflect God, is by being a creator. And so the arc of my life was this. As a child, I was a very creative kid. I loved to play. I loved to write. I loved to paint. I mean, don't most kids? I mean, whether it's finger painting or making up a story, like it's the most natural thing in the world for a kid to do is to be creative and playful. And then I, like many people, I grew up and I had to get a job and go to school, and then it's marriage and then it's kids. And all that creativity just got pushed down to this tiny corner of life. I had a few outlets here and there, but it was not a central part of my existence, creativity. After psychedelics, it was an explosion of creativity. I took up improv comedy. I perform on...
Which you're still doing, right?
I'm still doing the improv. Every month. I've opened for a comedian. I took up photography. I have photographs all over my living room wall from various places that I've traveled to. And I took up painting, and I realized, oh, I don't have a natural talent here. So what? And I have paintings hanging up that... you know, are not impressive, but they're impressive to me. Like, because that's creativity. That's the playfulness. It's not worrying about whether or not I'm good or if somebody's going to judge me. It's just allowing it to really flow. And so I think a creative outlet after psychedelics, it can be a really powerful way to process what's going on. These experiences in psychedelics are often kind of difficult to describe. They're ineffable. And so expressing them through art, maybe instead of, you know, words, can be very helpful. And yeah, we are by nature creators. And you can see that in children, how creative they are. And then as adults, that skill, that drive, just, it gets lost in life, right?
It gets lost in life and in the ego.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it if I'm not going to be good at it. Right.
The fear of being judged.
Yeah. I am not good at the guitar, but you know what? It doesn't matter. It's about play. It's about getting outside your comfort zone and seeing what magic might be there.
For some listeners who have never tried psychedelics or are interested, these principles in your book can be applied just to general living, living in life and experiences. I think that when we push ourselves, and we become this hero in life, psychedelics or we not, it opens us up to creative paths in ourselves that we can explore. We didn't even know existed. I think one that's very important is, like you say, live your elixir. Mm-hmm. And to take what you've learned on these journeys, especially life-changing journeys, and integrate them into life.
An interesting point that these principles are universal and beyond psychedelics. And yeah, if one were to, you know, read off the 10 principles, these are principles for life. Psychedelics are a tool. They are simply a tool. And for other people, there might be a more appropriate tool, but this is the tool that works for me. Setting intentions. I talk about opening your heart. I talk about loving yourself shamelessly. I talk about surrendering to life. None of those principles are unique to psychedelics. Those are principles of life.
So Benjamin, if someone is interested in psychedelics, say they've never done it before and they want to take that next step, where would somebody go to embark on a psilocybin journey and know that they're safe and get the best out of their experience?
Sure. And it's complicated, right? So I'll start by talking about the United States. So yeah, at the federal level, these are Schedule I drugs. And there are places where these have been decriminalized and are essentially available in the open. Oregon is a famous example of that. Colorado, as always, is leading the way. It's decriminalized there. There is a church in Oakland where it's decriminalized, Santa Cruz. Like there's these pockets of decriminalization where it is available. And also, let us not forget the freedom of religion. These are genuine sacraments. And so one can Google around and find a therapist to work with or a retreat center that's operating here in the United States. Retreat Guru is one source they could go to that lists off various psychedelic retreats. It's got reviews and information. So that's a good, credible source if you're looking to do a retreat type environment.
So would you say in the states where it is legal, because I think safety is really important when you're venturing into something like this, you need to be able to trust and have confidence in that community.
I mean, psychedelics, they put us in a very, very vulnerable state. And so we need to be held and protected by somebody who is reputable and knows what they're doing. And unfortunately, the psychedelic world is just like the rest of the world. There are predators out there. There are stories of practitioners taking advantage of people, either financially or sexually or in other ways. I wish those people weren't out there, but they are. But they are out there, and so we have to rely on, I think, the recommendations of people we trust. We need to do our research around, you know, who it is that's holding space before we do medicine with a facilitator. It's essential to put ourselves in a safe place. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Setting matters so much, so much.
And so I guess set being your mindset, mm-hmm. right? That how you're prepared to go into this journey, and then the setting, your environment, who's going to be there to make sure that you're safe while you're journeying, and then with integration after, how would somebody who's gone through a journey now come out of the journey with their elixir, integrate that? Are there psychotherapists out there? What are the avenues that you would recommend to somebody who's gone through this journey and now they want to continue and integrate what they've learned?
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. I appreciate you bringing that up. There's a phrase in the legal community that a man who represents himself in court has a fool for a client, something like that. And so, yeah, trying to be your own therapist, your own coach is probably a bad idea. And so if it's at all possible, I encourage everybody to work with either a therapist or a coach of some kind. There are, in this day and age, there are fortunately plenty of psychedelic-informed therapists out there. It can take a little work to find exactly the right match for you. Being True to You was that program, and I'll mention them because I was very impressed with the quality of their training. There's other certifications out there. MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, on their website, they have a list of therapists who have been trained, certified, recommended. I think that list is primarily MDMA focused, but fortunately, in this day and age, there are quite a few out there. And also, we live in the era of Zoom, so that therapist or coach doesn't necessarily have to live nearby, because that could be very limiting if you're living in rural Alabama. But in the world of Zoom, you can find one somewhere. And being a coach has been one of the most rewarding things that I have done. I mean, that's the thing. So I went on my hero's journey and I came out with this elixir of joy and love and lust for life. And what's the job of the hero after that? It's to share the elixir with other people. And so I felt like, well, I found this gold inside myself. Can I help you find gold inside yourself too? And that has been my journey as a coach.
So MAPS integration, like the what you said, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, might be somewhere someone might want to research and just look for somebody that's trained and has experience in integrating. I think there's the other designation called IFS.
Internal Family Systems. It is an independent process of psychedelics, but it's also a modality that is very popular in the psychedelic world because they blend together very well. We have all these different parts inside of ourselves, and psychedelics are a way for those parts to come out in the open, and it can make IFS therapy much more effective.
The book is a wonderful resource for anyone who is considering a psychedelic journey or who has been through one and can relate to your story of transformation through your hero dose. I hope that everyone who's listened here to the end has found this very interesting and enlightening. I certainly appreciate your time today. Is there a way that someone could get in touch with you or learn more about your book?
Certainly. Well, the book is available on Amazon.com, Trip of a Lifetime. They can also go to my website. It's very rudimentary at the time, but it's a landing spot and it has my email. It is benjaminforrest.com. And that's Forrest with one R like the trees, not Forrest with two R's like the Gump. So benjaminforrest.com. And I'm also very active on LinkedIn and especially on Instagram. So my Instagram handle is at benjamin.forrest.bliss, which was the handle I picked after my mushroom journey, and I was feeling rather blissy. So yeah, I can see all on Instagram, LinkedIn, or benjaminforrest.com, and the book is available on Amazon.
Fantastic. I'm excited for you, and I'm excited for your journey ahead. I think the book just launched, what, a week ago?
Less than a week. I think we're about 5 days out. And it's really heartwarming to see, the feedback and all the text messages I've been getting around it. It's catching fire. And thankfully, it's caught the attention of some players in the psychedelic world. This week, I was invited to be a speaker at Global Psychedelic Week on a veterans panel, and also invited to go visit the Mission Within and meet the president of that organization. The Mission Within is a organization devoted to veterans healing through psychedelics. So
I love the work that you're doing with veterans, for veterans. It's an important part of our society that needs to be, nurtured and paid attention to. I find your work deeply moving in that I like what you represent.
Thank you.
Benjamin, thank you so much for sharing your story and your heart with us. To everyone listening, remember, you don't have to step into a psychedelic journey to apply these lessons. The principles are universal. Love yourself shamelessly, savor aliveness, and lean into community. That's embodiment. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share it with someone who might need it, and join me next time as we keep exploring what it means to live fully, body, mind, and spirit.